Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Turkey's President Erdogan threatening to dump 3.6 million Syrian refugees on Europe unless they go along with his ethnic cleansing of the Kurds. Max Hoffman, the Associate Director on the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, whose research focuses on Turkey and the Kurdish regions, joins us from Brussels to discuss how the European allies were blindsided by Trump's move to sell out the Kurds and greenlight Erdogan's invasion of northern Syria, where French and British special forces are deployed with the American force Trump is precipitously pulling out. We will examine the absurdity of Trump's excuse that we need to pull our troops out of the endless wars when there are only 1,000 U.S. troops in Syria, whose small footprint gives the U.S. enormous leverage over the Assad regime, Russia, and Iran. And since the U.S. has a military presence in 186 countries around the world, why is it the 1,000 troops in Syria are Trump's priority? Unless he is taking his orders from Putin, who wants the Americans out of Syria, and last year even sent in a mercenary force to attack this small contingent of Americans who were able to inflict heavy casualties on Russia's Wagner Brigade, a private army owned by Putin's chef, Yevgeny Prigozhin. Then, after having sold out the Saudis by not coming to their aid after they were attacked by Iran, we will assess how much Trump is in the process of selling out the Israelis by removing America's roadblock on the Shia Crescent Highway from Tehran to Damascus, giving Iran a greater ability to supply heavy weapons to their proxy Hezbollah in Lebanon for a future attack on Israel. Daniel Byman, a professor of security studies and vice dean for undergraduate affairs at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service and author of Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad, joins us to discuss the difficulty dealing with a leader of the free world who, with demented ignorance, blames the Kurds for not helping us in World War II at Normandy. Then finally, we will speak with Tim Alberta, the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine, who covers Trump's presidency, Capitol Hill, and the ideological warfare between and within the two parties. He is the author of the new national bestseller, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. And we will discuss how Lincoln's party, founded on glorifying excellence and achievement, came to embrace the politics of anger, grievance, and contempt. Before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners who are helping us sustain and build Background Briefing online. We are grateful for the donations from across the nation and around the world coming in at backgroundbriefing.org/donate that keep us corporate free, fearless, and independent as we weaponize facts against authoritarian fictions to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now from Brussels is Max Hoffman, who's an Associate Director on the National Security and International Policy Team at the Center for American Security, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Hoffman.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you. And what's going on in Brussels in terms of the EU weighing in? This is an extraordinary situation. Nobody quite knows why President Trump did what he did. It doesn't make any sense. The entire U.S. national security establishment, the DOD, the State Department, the leader of the Republican leader of the Senate, Trump's close ally in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, everybody seems to be weighing in against it. So what are the Europeans doing? Trump said maybe they should pick up the slack.
Well, it's certainly a chaotic process leading to a pretty catastrophic decision from President Trump. He really seems to have put his sort of impulsive ideological views and I think campaign needs ahead of any strategic or, let alone moral or humanitarian concerns in pulling out of these areas and really green lighting this Turkish invasion. That invasion is going to spark widespread chaos and likely further displacement and humanitarian suffering, as well as pave the way for a likely ISIS resurgence. And all of those negative consequences are why the Europeans are distraught and scrambling to try and make sense of this decision and react to it. The British and the French in particular were completely blindsided by this move, despite the fact that they both have special forces on the ground next to the American Special Forces in Syria. But, you know, they didn't get so much as a courtesy call on this one. The European Union, meanwhile, has condemned the move and called for restraint from the Turks. But they have pretty limited leverage. Of course, they have 28 member states, and they're sort of operating on consensus on most of these issues. So even though the humanitarian consequences are dire and the likely refugee outflows affect Europe, less than Turkey, but still affect Europe, they have, you know, the right policy statement condemning this, but very little leverage over the issue at the moment. So really everyone's scrambling to react and hoping that this Turkish move is limited, at least initially, and that cooler heads prevail. But that's looking unlikely.
And the head of NATO made a rather strange statement, almost endorsing the Turkish point of view or the Turkish propaganda on this. What's the latest on that?
Well, I think Secretary General Stoltenberg is in a very difficult position. Of course, his primary mission is to try and hold this alliance together. He also had a previously scheduled trip to Turkey for Friday, so he'll be in Istanbul. And we'll see President Erdogan and Turkish leaders on Friday for what is sort of an unfortunately timed photo opportunity. But, you know, his main job is to try and hold NATO together in the face of this extremely disruptive unilateral Turkish move. So I sympathize with him. What I'd say is it does highlight what is now fast becoming, you know, one of the major issues that will confront the U.S. and its closest European allies moving forward, which is, you know, if Turkey is truly committed to this unilateral course in Syria and is committed to buying Russian S-400 missiles, the question of, you know, not Turkish membership in NATO yet, although we're heading down that road, but really how close a security partner Turkey can be in the near future, at least while Erdogan is making these decisions. That's something that does need to be addressed in a fundamental way, and it's something where the U.S. probably needs to start making contingency plans for the potential worst-case scenario with and in Turkey.
Well, all that, of course, plays right into Putin's hands. And there are some analysts who think that this Turkish move into Syria against the Kurds is also playing into Putin's hands, not to mention Iran's, because that small footprint of 1,000 U.S. Special Forces in that neighborhood accomplishes an awful lot. It's astride the route between Tehran and Damascus, which the Iranians want, particularly to supply Hezbollah, because it's expensive flying stuff in. It's right where the oil fields are that Assad wants. He's under an oil embargo, as we know. The tanker that was delayed was taken at Gibraltar, was released and finally unloaded oil. So he's desperate to have an oil supply. And Russia wants the U.S. out. They already sent their mercenaries in to attack the special forces, and they got badly beaten back. So we know what their motives are and what their intentions are. So this is the puzzling part. Who's Trump working for? United States or Russia?
You know, this move undoubtedly benefits Russia. And it's, of course, one of many Trump has made that is to the benefit of Russia, whether that's sort of selling Ukraine down the river or this. But I do think that Trump's primary motivation is selfish. He's really interested in just using this as a political talking point. I think he wants to say that he beat ISIS, even though you know, this is the continuation of an Obama strategy that led to ISIS's defeat, and that, you know, the insurgency is not actually defeated yet. He just wants to say, damn the facts, you know, we beat them and the boys are coming home. And of course, that's a popular message in the United States, but the reality is more complicated. And Russia will undoubtedly exploit this. Iran may, I think that's less certain. But the Assad regime is strengthened. The U.S. now has lost any leverage to try and really kind of coordinate a de-escalation of the Syrian war. And so now we'll probably enter a new phase in that war with further suffering, further displacement, and American credibility really shredded as we've abandoned our close partners, the Syrian Democratic Force, to their fate, sort of torn between this Turkish invasion and a resurgent ISIS insurgency.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Hoffman, who joins us from Brussels. He's the Associate Director on the National Security and International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. But we've already seen President Trump sell out his best buddy, MBS, Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. Now both the Emiratis and the Saudis are now basically going hat in hand to the Iranians after the Iranians almost destroyed an important or the key oil facility in Saudi Arabia. And the U.S. has basically, you know, didn't come to the Saudis' rescue, that's for sure. And you can see already that they're realizing that they're on their own and they're going to have to make a deal with Iran. So Iran is essentially controlling almost all of the Arab capitals now, with Damascus, with Baghdad, with Sana'a. And if they've got the Emiratis and the Saudis cowed, that for all of the support that and the bluster from Trump and Pompeo and company and Bolton, you just wonder what the hell happened there. And I guarantee you, and I'm hearing this from Israel, from Israeli security people, they are worried that they're going to get sold out. If the Iranians are able to have the Shia crescent with unimpeded and build up Hezbollah, there's talk in Israel of an expected Iranian attack on Israel within 2 months.
Well, I can't speak to, of course, to Hezbollah's plans. I would say that the Trump administration's policy towards the Gulf and towards Iran has been disastrous, but I would put a slightly different reason to it. I mean, I think the fundamental cause of this tremendous uncertainty and the prospect for further violence and the escalation we've seen thus far between Iran and Saudi Arabia is really down to Trump tearing up the Iran nuclear agreement that had been painstakingly negotiated with the P5 plus one, so, you know, the major powers and our close allies, to limit Iranian nuclear activities. And he tore that up with no plan for what would come afterwards. And he has embarked on this maximum pressure campaign, which I think plays well, again, to his domestic base, but leaves Iran backed into a corner and has led Tehran to escalate on a variety of fronts and really empower the hardliners there. So, you know, that may not have been a perfect deal, but it was better than nothing. And to tear it up with no plan for what came afterwards and with no buy-in from your allies was extremely rash and really in keeping with, you know, Trump's overall foreign policy, which is about domestic political talking points and pretty unrelated to the facts. So, you know, with Saudi Arabia, I think the Saudis and the Emiratis are now worried that actually Trump has gone too far, that they're left on their own, that he's unreliable, and they have, you know, having egged on the U.S., they're wondering where to go from here, because none of them, with their economies dependent on oil exports, can really risk a major war.
Well, but what are you hearing from the Israelis? Because they're quite worried about what's happening, and, you know, Trump's been incredibly popular in Israel, and it looks like Adelson and Netanyahu, for all of their investment, particularly Adelson, who's the biggest donor to Trump, nothing that's happening now in the Kurdish region of Syria by pulling the U.S. out, handing it over to Russia and Iran, is in any way helps Israel.
No, this move certainly doesn't help Israel. It doesn't help regional stability. I mean, I don't think anyone in the United States was eager to keep U.S. troops there indefinitely. But the reality was that a relatively small deployment and at a relatively small cost, with very few American casualties, was helping stabilize a huge swath of Syria and hold back any ISIS resurgence, you know, to a remarkable extent. And a big part of that was the mainly Kurdish partners, the SDF that we had worked with. And Trump has really just thrown all of that out the window and thrown this whole big section of Syria into total chaos. Again, as you say, empowering both Assad and the Russians and the Iranians. And so that is, of course, of huge concern to the Israeli government, who themselves, I would say, have not necessarily helped the situation by their, you know, really maximalist position on any domestic or any peace process with the Palestinians. So, I mean, Bibi Netanyahu has not helped the cause of regional stability either, but he hasn't done as much damage as Donald Trump has in his short 3-year stint in charge.
But, Max, we have troops in 186 countries around the world. We have 1,000 troops in this key position. We have enormous leverage. 1,000 troops in northern Syria provide enormous leverage for the United States. They protect the Kurds. They stop ISIS from regrouping and maintaining that 90,000 of them, so 70-plus thousand family members of ISIS and about 12 to 15,000 actual fighters. And they control Assad's oil fields, which he desperately wants. And they stop the Iranians from having a free access from Tehran to Damascus. For that, at the cost of 1,000 troops, and we got troops in 186 countries, none of it makes any sense. It's only 1,000 troops. Why is this Trump's number one priority?
I mean, listen, Ian, I agree with you. I think that this was, you know, Americans have a lot of opinions on the use of force, on the deployment of troops abroad. I think there's a general sense dated back, you know, really rooted in the Iraq war, and embodied in part by Obama and certainly in a perverse way by Trump, that we're overextended, that we shouldn't be policing all of these areas. And I understand that, and I share some of that. But this was, as you say, a deployment which was morally right. We helped defeat ISIS and prevent the resurgence. ISIS was beheading people, enslaving women at an industrial scale, and exporting terror attacks. And, you know, it was morally right. It was strategically in our interest because it helped stabilize this area. It gave us leverage to hopefully end the Syrian war at some point. And it was an acceptable cost, as you say. So, yes, I agree. I think this deployment made sense. And Donald Trump's decision has totally, totally thrown it, you know, out the window, and undermined any viability it may have had. Now, this is ideologically consistent with his approach. You know, he thinks that the U.S. is being taken advantage of by all sorts of powers. The facts don't really matter. He's got a very superficial understanding of all of this, but that's his position. So it's ideologically consistent, I suppose, with his position, and it's politically convenient. Again, he just wants to go into the 2020 campaign saying, I brought the boys home and we beat ISIS, facts, you know, notwithstanding. So I share your frustration with this decision. I think it's going to have dire consequences, both in terms of humanitarian suffering and displacement. You know, people will die for Trump to have this political talking point. And it's not in the United States' interest, but it is, I suppose, in keeping with the man's sort of philosophy. And it's certainly in keeping, he thinks, with his political interest, though that may backfire if it leads to an ISIS resurgence.
Well, just in closing, not only has Trump done this and allowed, and of course, I wanted to mention that there's a tweet from Benjamin Netanyahu. Israel strongly condemns the Turkish invasion of the Kurdish areas of Syria and warns against the ethnic cleansing of the Kurds by Turkey and its proxies. Israel is prepared to extend humanitarian assistance to the gallant Kurdish people. So it's not just that Trump is rewarding Russia, Assad, and Iran. He's also rewarding Erdogan by, one, giving him a green light to ethnically cleanse the Kurds, and there's a political reason why Erdogan's doing it. He's losing favor with the public, so he's rallying them around the flag to revive his political fortunes. So the whole thing is deeply cynical. But on top of that, President Trump gave Erdogan a reward. He invited him to the White House, which is not what you normally do when you're rewarding somebody. So the whole thing is extraordinary. So just in the context of Erdogan showing up here in a month, what do you think is going to happen with Lindsey Graham and Chris Van Hollen's bill? It looks like the Senate and the House are so angry at Turkey that they'll have a veto-proof majority. I know Trump basically doesn't act even when he's supposed to. He holds up sanctions against Russia, etc. But looking forward in the next few weeks to up to a month, how do you see the politics of this playing out on Capitol Hill with Erdogan showing up here in the United States with the legislative branch of the United States government in total hostility to him, not to mention the DOD and the State Department?
Well, it's going to be a messy visit, and you're right. It is absurd to reward President Erdogan, who has really, you know, taken Turkey in a definitively authoritarian direction, particularly over the last 7 years. Ridiculous to reward him, not just in the context of that democratic backsliding, but also after he's flouted American interests in Syria and also on the purchase of the Russian S-400, which, you know, is a strategic risk to U.S. and NATO's military and technological edge over Russia. So, you know, he's really not behaved as an ally or a friend should, and he gets rewarded for it. So it's It's crazy. It's also, again, sort of in keeping with Trump's past behavior. He seems to admire these authoritarian figures for some reason. He likes these guys maybe because he thinks he can do business with them and cut deals that make him look good at home. But it's absurd, and it will be very messy because, as you say, there really are no friends for Turkey left on Capitol Hill. I think that the sanctions package introduced by Senator Graham and Van Hollen, it's unbelievably broad and punitive. It would be devastating to Turkey. It represents a nuclear option. I suspect that if, you know, whatever is eventually adopted will be watered down somewhat, but make no mistake, the mood on Capitol Hill is to punish Turkey for this step. And I do think that they'll have a supermajority to force Trump's hand at some limited level, even if he has, you know, no desire to punish Erdogan despite his outrageous moves.
Well, Max Hoffman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you, Ian. Always great to talk to you.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Hoffman, who is an associate director on the National Security International Policy Team at the Center for American Progress, focusing on Turkey and the Kurdish regions. And he joined us from Brussels.
We can take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump, who has just sold out the Saudis, is in the process of selling out the Israelis. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Daniel Byman, a professor of security studies and vice dean for undergraduate affairs at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in Armies of Jihad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Byman.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Daniel. And I want to talk to you about Israeli reactions to Trump's move in northern Syria, which has alarmed allies. There's no question that the Israelis were caught off guard, as were the British and the French, who actually have special forces units on the ground there with the Americans in the Kurdish area that's now under attack from the Turks. But I'd like to go back a little bit, because all of this talk about Trump selling out the Kurds and selling out the U.S. position in Syria, not getting anything in return, which, of course, it makes a mockery of the art of the deal. But just to go back only a few weeks, it looks as if a similar thing happened with the Saudis. I mean, the Saudis' main oil terminal got attacked by Iran, and the U.S. did nothing. And obviously, the Saudis, Mohammed bin Salman, who's been in a sort of de facto alliance with Trump or Pompeo and Netanyahu, etc., suddenly it looks like that whole thing's fallen apart. MBZ, the Emirati leader, has made a deal with the Iranians, or he's in the process of making a deal, and the expectation is that the Saudis will have to bow to Iranian hegemony. So if we're going to be talking about Trump selling out Israel in terms of its Syria, could we start talking about whether or not Trump just sold out his friend Mohammed bin Salman?
What Trump wants to do is, frankly, what many Americans want, which is to remove the United States from the Middle East and to minimize military involvement there. So he has refrained from attacking Iran over Saudi Arabia. He's trying to pull out of Syria in response to Turkish pressure. And the problem is he's doing so without coordinating with allies, and he's doing so without thinking of the long-term consequences. So this does embolden Iran and give it new opportunities. It does sell out the Kurds and others who have been fighting the Islamic State. And it's doing so in a way that is dangerous for American interest in the long term.
So in terms of what we're hearing about Israel's attitude, for example, Dan Shapiro, the former U.S. ambassador to Israel under Barack Obama, said that the Israelis now are coming to terms with the cold, hard reality that Trump's isolationist instincts and his chaotic, impulsive decision-making can actually be very damaging to their interests. And the expert on U.S.-Israeli relations at Israel's Bar-Ilan University, Eitan Gilboa, says that the main image is a very weak U.S. that does not help its allies. It deserts its allies. How important is that aspect of it, the idea that in the eyes of the world we're seen as, you know, unreliable, to put it mildly?
So one thing that allies in Europe, allies in Asia could count on was that the United States would be there, that if enemies were threatening, the United States would support them, and that the U.S. presence was for the long term, regardless of whether there was a Democrat or a Republican in the White House. And what Trump is showing is that expectation is no more, that U.S. Policy is going to oscillate. The United States will not be there supporting allies. And in fact, the United States might even be coddling enemies like Russia. And we see this quite profoundly in the Middle East, where a number of regional dictators were very excited about Trump because he was quite clear he did not care about human rights. But he also, in general, doesn't care about the Middle East and seems to want to remove the United States from the region, which he sees as simply a disaster and wants nothing to do with.
But does he care about Israel?
I certainly think Trump cares about Israel, but his view of Israel seems to be that it's strong and that if there's ever a war, the United States will support it. But the broader U.S. role in the Middle East, which is something that Israel has long counted on, Trump doesn't support. And so his concern for Israel doesn't go that far.
And again, I'm speaking with Daniel Byman, who's a professor of security studies and the vice dean for undergraduate affairs at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad. So we already have Erdogan, in fact, he's actually threatening Europe. He's saying that unless you Europeans go along with my ethnic cleansing of the Kurds, I'm going to dump 3.6 million refugees on you. And we all know what happened the last time that refugees were dumped on Europe. It's had a long-standing effect. It's led to the rise of right-wing parties in Western Europe, even in Scandinavia. It's led to countries like Poland and Hungary becoming more and more authoritarian. And I remember at the time it happened, the last exodus was just shortly after the Russians were deployed in Syria, leading the head of NATO at the time, the SACEUR, to say that Putin was weaponizing refugees. You just made reference to Putin being the winner, I guess, is what you're implying in this latest move by Trump. Is that a threat that not only Erdogan is dangling or threatening to use, but is that a threat that has already served Putin's interests?
Erdogan's threat is quite real, that even a relatively small increase in the flow of migrants who are currently in Turkey and having them go on to other European countries would royal politics there. It would be tremendously unpopular in most countries, and thus Erdogan has a potential weapon to use the misery of millions of refugees to Turkey's advantage. And Trump himself has shown that he doesn't care about Europe. One of his comments when people talked about Islamic State fighters possibly being freed from Syrian Kurdish prison camps was that, don't worry, they'll go to Europe. In other words, he doesn't really care because he doesn't think the problem is going to be focused on America. And this definitely does help Russia. And it helps Russia show that, in contrast to America, it's going to be a much more stable force in world affairs. In contrast to America and the Middle East, it's going to be there. So countries like Israel and Saudi Arabia have to recognize not only the American decline in the region, but also the ascent of Russia. And in general, the disagreements within institutions and within alliances and between Western allies all makes Russia stronger.
Well, but I don't know how you can deal with a president who doesn't seem to understand anything about history or makes up his own history, because not only did the president just say what you mentioned, which is pretty extraordinary, he also went on to say that the Kurds did not help us in World War II. They did not help us at Normandy. Now, first of all, the Kurds have never had a country. That's the whole point of their struggle. They've been a part of Turkey, and Turkey was neutral in World War II. What is he talking about?
He's talking about whatever random thought comes through his head that particular second. He's not someone who pays attention to briefings. He's not someone who cares about the opinion of experts. He's not someone who has the intellectual curiosity to learn on his own. So he's just spouting whatever nonsense seems to come to mind. And he does this not only to the American people, but on an international stage. And as a result, the standing of the United States is declining around the world.
So is there any way, I mean, if you have a president like that, you would think you would have sort of courtiers following him that would do damage control and say, well, this is not really what he means, or this is not really a change in U.S. foreign policy. I take it that sort of happened in the earlier days of this administration, where you had the so-called adults in the room. But is that the problem now? There is simply nobody around to correct him, to point out what he's talking about is absolute nonsense?
Most of the people who were willing to publicly correct the president or otherwise stand up to him have been fired or have moved on. So Secretary Mattis moved on, Secretary Tillerson moved on, a number of people who, people may or may not agree with their politics, but were definitely willing to stand up. And now we are left with individuals who are trying to serve the president regardless of what he says each day. So if he changes his opinion 180 degrees, they will change their support 180 degrees. So we see Secretary Pompeo, for example, trying to defend the very precipitous U.S. military withdrawal by saying U.S. troops were in jeopardy from a Turkish assault. That was simply not true, but he's trying to justify the policies of the president.
Well, one wonders, though, you were saying earlier that this is all plays well with his base, that does it really? I mean, the idea of this kind of treachery, does it play? The idea of selling out the people that fought and died for us, I think 11,000 Kurdish fighters, many of them women, died, 22,000 were wounded. We all know how terrible the Islamic State is. You don't think that resonates at all?
It may resonate a bit, but I think among his base, but also among many people who oppose him, the idea of a significant U.S. commitment to the Middle East, including a significant military commitment, is not popular. After the problems with the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, there wasn't eagerness on either side of the political aisle to have a robust policy in the Middle East. President Obama was very cautious in the Middle East. And I think what Trump is doing is harnessing broader popular concerns about the region. And this is something that certainly among a significant sector of the American population resonates.
But do you think, given the objection from Trump's friend in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican head of the Senate, and this bill that Lindsey Graham and Chris Van Hollen, the bipartisan sanctions bill that they're putting together, how do you see that affecting the isolationist politics of Trump and his base? Because what looks like is going to happen here, they're going to get a veto-proof majority, and this will probably come to a head, will it not, when Erdogan shows up here for a White House visit. I mean, not only did Trump pull the rug out from under the Kurds and from defying the national security establishment in Washington, D.C. and our allies, on top of that, he rewarded Erdogan with an invitation to the White House.
The president hates any public criticism, and so he is much more likely to turn on Senator McConnell, to turn on Senator Graham, than he is to heed their warnings or to change his policy in response to their pressure. He's someone who, in response to any criticism, doubles down. So I think he'll stick it out. Over time, you'll have a number of senators who will be politically nervous and reluctant to go against the president in public. So whether they can get a veto-proof majority, to me, is a very open question. And then often by the time this happens, it may be too late. The Turkish military operation may be over. The Kurds may be devastated. The consequences with regard to the Islamic State may have already occurred.
But do you think that this ethnic cleansing and the relocation of the Syrian refugees, it doesn't make any sense on the surface, because most of those refugees are from urban areas of Syria like Damascus, etc. They're not farmers. So you replace a bunch of Kurdish farmers and then you plonk down a bunch of urban Syrians and say, this is your new land. Do you see that working out?
Turkish plan is in part really kind of moving the refugee and detention areas off Turkish soil. So it's not a long-term plan in the sense that people are going to be able to farm and sustain themselves. People may use rhetoric to that effect, but that's not really what Turkey expects. Rather, they expect that the humanitarian missions will all simply shift, and the very large refugee presence in Turkey will start to abate, and Turkey will have a way to kind of reduce this problem on its own soil and be able to kind of push it off and make it much more of a problem for the international community.
But the Kurds are not going to go away, are they? I mean, I don't know where they'll go. But I can't imagine he's going to be able to, ethnically cleanse them. And also, I don't know what's going to happen to the 70,000 to 90,000 ISIS families and fighters detained.
So most of the Kurdish people will not go away. But their leadership, and especially the militants who are armed, are likely to be driven out of the area. So Turkey will be able to assume political control. And as a result, have the dominance it wants in that area.
So, and what do you think will happen to ISIS, the 70,000 family, 12,000 odd fighters?
So this is a very big question. Some of them are likely to go to Iraq. Some of them will still be held by the Kurds in areas they continue to control. But whether they will escape, whether the Kurds will simply allow them to escape because the Kurds will be focused on the Turks, that's a genuine question mark.
Well, just in closing, back to Israel's attitudes and what's going on in Israel in terms of whether they feel that they're to some extent being sold out by Trump. The idea that the U.S. small footprint there of 1,000 soldiers astride the main Shia crescent route from Tehran to Damascus and then into Lebanon, how significant is that? Because I understand that a lot of supplies to Hezbollah coming from Iran have to be flown in. Would that be a big boon if the Americans get out of the way? We know it would be for the Russians because they already tried to attack the American position using these mercenaries. But how much of a boon would it be to Hezbollah? And is that likely to embolden Iran to increase pressure on Israel, if not launch an attack?
Having a better land corridor from Iran through Iraq, through Syria to Lebanon would certainly be advantageous to both Iran and Hezbollah. However, it's not a massive shift in that Hezbollah is already very well armed and has most of the supplies it needs. So it certainly helps and makes things easier, but it's a benefit that people on the ground will care about, Israelis will care about, but already Hezbollah poses a very grave threat to Israel, and the increase in the land corridor doesn't change that dramatically.
Well, Daniel Barman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Daniel Barman, who's a professor of security studies and the vice dean for undergraduate affairs at Georgetown University's Walsh School of Foreign Service, as well as a senior fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He served on the 9/11 Commission staff and is the author of Road Warriors, Foreign Fighters in the Armies of Jihad. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Tim Alberta, the author of the national bestseller American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump.
down, man.
Red Paul.
Sit down, man.
LL Cool J.
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Tim Alberta, who is a chief political correspondent for Politico magazine, who covers Donald Trump's presidency, Capitol Hill, the ideological warfare between and within the two parties, demographic change in America, and the evolving role of money in politics. He's the author of the new book, a national bestseller, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Alberta.
Thank you for having me.
So do you think that there is a moment now of some kind of fissure in terms of what seems like pretty solid, unbreakable support for Donald Trump amongst Republicans, particularly in the U.S. Senate, with the condemnation by Mitch McConnell and particularly Lindsey Graham over what's now happening in the north of Syria, which could get much, much worse, could turn into quite a disaster, particularly if the Russians get involved, which there's rumors to that effect. And we have pictures of the Kurds being slaughtered after having been the boots on the ground that defeated ISIS. And even worse, if all these, 70-plus thousand ISIS people suddenly are set free. So let's touch on that moment now. Do you see this as something that could get worse for Trump?
You know, I would draw a distinction between what is a policy break and what is a personal break with Trump and the Republican Party around him. Donald Trump does not seem to care much about a dissension in the ranks when it comes to policy matters, whether that be over trade, whether it be over health care, and whether it be over foreign policy. Donald Trump did not campaign for office on any sort of an orthodox conservative Republican agenda, and everybody understood that. The times at which you have seen the president lash out at the members of his own party are the times at which there is some existential personal crisis facing the president, whether that be during the Mueller report, whether it be something involving his children, whether it be most recently involving the call with the Ukrainian president and the allegations of quid pro quo in attempting to get foreign governments to investigate his political opponents. Those are things that pose existential threats to the Trump presidency, and therefore those are the things that Republican lawmakers in Washington understand that they need to steer clear of, that they need to be very careful in voicing any sort of criticisms or condemnations of the president. However, when it comes to something like the situation in Syria and effectively giving a green light to the Turkish government to invade northern Syria and potentially slaughter our Kurdish allies, that is something that Republican lawmakers know they can afford to speak out on because the president will see their criticisms. He might disagree with them. He might sneer at them. He might laugh at them. He might dismiss them. But he's certainly not going to take it personally. It's not going to be some deal breaker in this shotgun marriage between Trump and the GOP. That's why you will hear Republican lawmakers talk about picking and choosing their spots where they can afford to be critical of the president because they understand that this is not going to be any sort of a lasting fissure.
So what then explains, or perhaps you have explained, this sort of disconnect, if you will, between Trump's popularity amongst Republicans being as high as ever between the 80% and 90%, and yet there's been an increase in those who support Trump's impeachment?
Well, we don't know that there has been any increase in those who support Trump's impeachment among Republicans. We've seen a very limited body of data polling so far to suggest that there could be some uptick in Republicans who are turning against the president. But until we see a healthy body of survey data to really give us a fuller picture of that, we won't know that for sure. What we do know is that while the president does continue to poll very well among self-identified Republicans, we also know that the Republican Party itself is shrinking. You can see that in the same polls because identifying as a member of a party is a mood. It is an inherently flexible question that can be asked by pollsters, and respondents can answer it depending on the mood that they're in that day. And the fact of the matter is, when you see simultaneously the president having very strong approval ratings among self-identified Republicans in some of these congressional districts in 2018 that were ultimately lost by Republican candidates, that tells you that there is an inherent contradiction there, and that ultimately, while the president may be strong among his core base of supporters, he does not perhaps have the support of a broader coalition of Republican voters.
Well, your book, which is a national bestseller, really does ask some of the questions which are vexing and puzzling, particularly for progressives. How did a party once obsessed with national insolvency come to champion trillion-dollar deficits? How did the party of compassionate conservatism become the party of Muslim bans and family separations? How did the party of family values elect a thrice-married philanderer? And most important, how long can such a party survive? So, can you answer the last one?
Well, no, I can't. Although I certainly think that the Republican Party is going to face a period of reckoning whenever it is that Donald Trump leaves office, whether that's, he's impeached and removed this year, or he wins re-election and he's around for another 5 years. At some point, Donald Trump is not going to be the president anymore, and there will have to be a serious period of self-reflection among Republicans, especially those who once were vehemently opposed to Donald Trump and his brand of politics, and then became his chief enablers. And of course, I'm talking about, you know, people like Lindsey Graham. There's a real question about the role that some of these prominent Republican elected officials played in sort of creating this monster that ultimately sort of took over the Republican Party. And I think that that's obviously a question that's not going to be answered overnight. It's going to probably take several beatings at the ballot box for Republicans to face up to exactly what has happened to a party that has a proud tradition and that was not always viewed as this sort of, you know, narrow-minded, anti-intellectual, lowest common denominator political entity. And obviously, you know, you do have people like Nikki Haley and like Ted Cruz and like Marco Rubio and other young Republicans who have had their own accommodations with Trump, but who also simultaneously view themselves as future presidents of the United States. And, you know, nowhere will that tension be on greater display than among some of those very Republicans who are going to have to try and navigate exactly how they capture and maintain some of that support that Donald Trump has tapped into among the populist working class wing of the conservative base, while simultaneously expanding the party and trying to reach many of the voters, young people, minorities, college-educated women who have been repelled by this president.
Well, Nikki Haley and company may get their chance if Trump's impeached. My sense is that liberals should be careful what they wish for. Do you think it's possible that – I don't see Pence as being particularly popular. So if there was an impeachment, and it may happen soon, and I don't know where they'll get the votes in the Senate, but assuming they do you think that's a possibility, that it would be opened up and, you know, people like Nikki Haley would jump in along with maybe Tucker Carlson, the guy from New Hampshire that was insulting towards the House? What's his name?
Guy from New Hampshire, you're not talking about Corey Lewandowski.
Yeah, Corey Lewandowski, right. Yeah.
Well, look, I think if we're operating in a world, in a scenario under which the president is impeached by the House and removed by the Senate, then absolutely you would see you would see Pandora's box opened, and there would be no claim whatsoever that Mike Pence would have to becoming the heir apparent and succeeding Donald Trump atop the ticket in 2020. It would be wide open. You would see Haley. You would see Cruz. You could see Rubio. You would see Tom Cotton. You would see a couple of governors jump in. You would see all kinds of Republicans throw their hats in the ring. But I think let's make it very clear, that is almost impossible to imagine happening as far as the president actually being removed by the Senate. If, in fact, the House of Representatives votes to impeach Donald Trump, you would need 20 Republican senators to then defect and vote with a unified Democratic caucus in the Senate to convict Donald Trump, because you need a two-thirds majority in the upper chamber. And that is It's about as unlikely to occur as, you know, space aliens landing here tomorrow. And it's just there are lots of folks in Washington who are playing the parlor game of imagining who might cross that line and how many Republican senators might be daring enough to put their vote in that historical context against Donald Trump. But, you know, to the extent that there might be two or three who have the courage to do that, it's certainly not going to be 20.
Sure. And again, I'm speaking with Tim Alberta, who's the chief political correspondent for Politico magazine. He covers Donald Trump's presidency, Capitol Hill, the ideological warfare between and within the two parties, demographic change in America, and the evolving role of money in elections. And he's the author of the new book, a national bestseller, American Carnage, on the front lines of the Republican Civil War and the rise of President Trump. Well, what you were touching on early before I sidetracked you with that scenario is parties come and go in our history. In the 1850s, the Whigs all but disappeared, and they split into the kind of nativist know-nothings and into the progressive GOP under Abraham Lincoln. So it does happen. One of the things I found out recently in an interview with Tom LoBianco, who's done a biography on Pence, was that the Republican establishment, as your book makes clear, were just terrified of Trump. They couldn't believe it, particularly when the whole presidential primary debate ended up like a reality TV show, and he knocked everybody off the island, in particular Jeb Bush, who was humiliated. But Jeb Bush's brother, George W., apparently, through intermediaries, got in touch with Pence and begged him after the Access Hollywood tape to split with Trump. And that's, of course, a bit of an irony, is it not, that Pence, if he's not entirely happy with Trump, and I'd like to get your opinion on that. Rumors are that a lot of people like Mitch McConnell and others, and obviously Paul Ryan, aren't privately happy with him. But are you aware of that incident?
Well, yeah, look, I think it's important to recognize that, and I can't quite overstate this enough, that what Republicans will say about Donald Trump in public, and especially, you know, on talk radio or on Fox News, is in many cases 180 degrees diametrically different than what they will say about Donald Trump when they are talking with you privately. And listen, Trump in some cases knows this. He is aware of the degree, the extent of the duplicity, but I cannot possibly emphasize enough for just everyday Americans who are not attuned to what's happening in Washington and who catch a little bit of news, you know, in the slivers of their busy days, going to work and taking their kids to soccer practice. There is a real and pervasive concern about this president among the members of his own party, in the U.S. Senate, in the U.S. House, in the highest leadership positions that there are. But these people are terrified to cross Donald Trump. They have come to understand, and rightly so, that if they are going to come out in opposition in any meaningful way and really challenge Donald Trump, again, in that existential sense I was talking about earlier, questioning his fitness for office, questioning some of, you know, some of the legitimacies of his administration in their workings with foreign governments, any of these things that really will push the president's buttons, they are taking their career into their hands at that point. They are risking losing their job, losing their reputations, losing their livelihoods. And that is something that for most of these people is just an unacceptable risk. They understand that what happened to Jeff Flake, to Bob Corker, to Mark Sanford, to Justin Amash, it could happen to them as well. And so, you know, the reason that most of these folks are unwilling to cross that threshold isn't just because they're afraid of Donald Trump. I think more accurately, it's important to understand they're afraid of Donald Trump's voters. Republican voters who identify as Trump supporters in these congressional districts across the country, they have made it clear time and again that if forced to choose between Donald Trump and their local elected representative, they will choose Trump 10 times out of 10. And that is why most of these folks are simply unwilling to cross him in any meaningful way.
But is Trump a catalyst for a kind of cultural change in this country? Some have argued, for example, Sean Wilentz in reviewing your book, that it sort of goes back to Sarah Palin, the idea that there was a change, that people used to vote for people that they considered more qualified, more educated than them, and then suddenly they were able to vote for people that they thought, oh, you know, they're just like us. And I have a real sense that the American people are sick of politicians. I'm sick of them too. They all speak the same. They have the same kind of rhythm. There's something kind of genetic about them all. And people that are not politicians are kind of refreshing. So how much of this is cultural, and how much have we become more of a Jerry Springer culture than a William F. Buckley culture?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's hard to quantify just how much we've become a Jerry Springer culture. But I think that you've put your finger right on the pulse. Most of, you know, the questions you were asking earlier, how does a party that, you know, seems to care about or once declared that they care so deeply about national insolvency come to champion trillion-dollar deficits? The answer is very simple, that most voters aren't terribly ideological, and most voters actually don't care all that much about policy. Their decisions in the ballot box, when they step in and pull that curtain closed behind them and decide who they want to be the leader of the free world, that decision is informed by a lot of things. It is informed in many cases in large part by emotion and by cultural affiliation and mood. It is not typically all that informed by policy specifics. And Trump, give him credit, and Palin before him, to your point, these were folks who understood that at a baseline level, that many of the Tea Party activists, many of the Trump voters, many of the anti-establishment voices in the Republican Party during this post-Bush era that I write about in the book, they were animated far more by a sense of cultural grievance and socioeconomic displacement and lost community than they were the specifics of a spending bill or a deficit fight. That's just not what was galvanizing and really animating large parts of the electorate. And so most of these Republican elected officials who were trying to defeat Donald Trump in 2016, they're making these very academic, intellectual arguments, and Donald Trump is just gliding right past them, speaking to something very differently that they don't really even know exists. And that is ultimately why he was able to build this connection, forge this connection with voters that left the rest of these very accomplished, very smart, very highly thought of Republican presidential candidates just dumbfounded and sort of wondering what had just happened. And I think the bad news is that was probably just the tip of the iceberg, that we are not going to be going back to normal anytime soon, that anybody who thinks that Trump is just an anomaly and that once he leaves office, the temperature is going to decrease and that we're going to get back to a more recognizable state of politics is probably kidding themselves, because what Trump exposed is something very real that you were just speaking to about the culture informing much more of this than we ever realized previously.
So given the impasse on Capitol Hill, a real battle between the executive and the legislative branches over impeachment, of course, President Trump's portraying it all as a coup and the impeachment as an attempt to undo his 2016 election and therefore violate the votes of his supporters, is there any sense that there is a way for the Democrats to reach Trump's very loyal base to make these constitutional arguments? One of which, of course, is that Trump's stonewalling in itself is impeachable.
It's a good question. I've talked with congressional Republicans about this, including some who believe that the president's behavior is very much, approaching a point at which impeachment is not, out of the question and not an unreasonable proposition, although most of them would never say so publicly. What they say is that both for them and for their constituents back home who are loyal to the president, what they would need is something that is truly a smoking gun. And not in the sense of the Ukraine call where is implied quid pro quo, but the Biden's name is never mentioned. And there's some debate, there's some, plausible deniability about what the president is asking for. What I've been told by congressional Republicans is that what they would need is something that is both beyond the pale and something that is absolutely shatterproof, something that the president is caught doing or saying that is exposed and that cannot be defended, that cannot be explained away, that cannot be sort of couched in any sort of an excuse. That is what I've been told repeatedly, is that if Republicans would even entertain the prospect of endangering their careers by challenging the president in that way, that they would have to be on incredibly solid footing, and they just don't feel like anything they've seen thus far fits that criteria.
And you don't think what's happening now in the north of Syria, the possible slaughter of the Kurds, the release of these ISIS prisoners, that doesn't rise to that?
Not for them, I don't think it does. No, I think most Republicans, as disgusted and disappointed and angered as they are by his decision regarding Syria, they chalk this up to a president's ability to dictate American foreign policy. They wouldn't view it as an impeachable offense, because an impeachable offense would you're talking about high crimes and misdemeanors, and a foreign policy decision such as withdrawing troops from a region of the world, it would not fit that bill under really anybody's description.
So would it take then evidence that maybe Trump's doing this at Putin's behest? The impeachment clause in the Constitution says treason, bribery,
yes,
and high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yes. Well, and look, yes. So I think if there was some ironclad evidence to suggest that this decision was made at the behest of Vladimir Putin or to directly benefit Vladimir Putin or something of that nature, then certainly, yes, then you would be crossing into that danger zone for Republicans that they talk about. But again, you just have to keep in mind how incredibly steadfast the voters in these Republican congressional districts and Republican states have been to the president. And the reason you're not seeing more of these elected officials in Washington split with the president is because their voters back home have not yet split the president. It's important to recognize that, you know, elected officials are reactionaries more than they are leaders. They are often, almost always, in fact, acting upon and in accordance with and in reaction to what they see and hear back home. And if they're not seeing and hearing a lot of anger and disappointment and sense of betrayal with the president back home from their Republican constituents, then they're not going to reflect that when they come back to Washington. That's just the way that this thing works.
So to the Democrats, though, is there a way that they can reach these people who are so loyal to Trump, his core? I mean, obviously, Hillary Clinton did the Democrats no favor by describing many of these people as deplorables. Is there any way they can win back the white working class?
Not in the short term, but I do believe that over the long haul, that absolutely there's an opportunity for Democrats to make, you know, and you've seen Elizabeth Warren do this in her own way, which is to make that same populist economic appeal that was so successful for Donald Trump in 2016. Obviously, the issue for any Democrat is going to be, especially for a progressive Democrat like Elizabeth Warren, is going to be that, to the earlier point in our conversation, all of the economic and pocketbook issues could line up perfectly with those white working class voters. But if you are seen as culturally far to the left of these voters, then you're going to have a very hard time winning them over. Because ultimately what Donald Trump figured out, again, is that to wield those cultural wedge issues in the pursuit of these voters is far more effective, far more powerful than speaking to any one economic concern, and certainly marrying the two, the economic concerns and the cultural concerns. That is where Trump's sweet spot really has been and continues to be. And so for a Democrat to try to imitate the one while being way to the left on the other, I just don't know that that's going to work. I think it would probably take a far more culturally moderate Democrat with that economically populist appeal to have a chance to break through and win back some of those voters.
So Elizabeth Warren has to be the Elizabeth Warren from Oklahoma, not the one from Massachusetts.
Well, you know, and look, I don't know that that's how she wins a general election, frankly, because in modern American politics, you tend to win elections by mobilizing your base, not by persuading the other side. And so, and we've seen that quite, you know, almost like clockwork over the last, you know, two decades in American politics. Whenever one party enjoys a big wave election cycle, it's because they have mobilized the base. It's not because they've reached across the aisle and won large swaths of the other party's voters. And so Elizabeth Warren, if she's going to be the president one day, I think is probably smart to bank on a strategy that is built around turning out every voting age center left individual in the United States of America, rather than trying to straddle the middle of the electorate in a way that is kind of inauthentic for her.
Since we have a very progressive audience, Tim, what would you say to our audience in terms of why they need to read your book?
Well, I think for a progressive audience or for a conservative audience, the answer I would give is pretty simple. I have three young children, and one day they are going to be in their high school history classes trying to figure out what on earth was happening during this period of American history, a very strange, turbulent, chaotic period of American political history. And what I try to do is place Donald Trump's presidency in a much broader context than just the 2016 election or, you know, WikiLeaks or Hillary Clinton being investigated for her emails or any of those things that we tend to concentrate on, the Mueller investigation. What I try to explain is that between the collision of these cultural forces I was just describing, massive economic disruption with millions of jobs being lost, a political terrain that was becoming totally asymmetrical in a way that nobody had fully recognized or appreciated, all of these stars were sort of aligning to create an environment that was conducive to somebody like Donald Trump, a demagogue, coming along and hijacking the Republican Party in the way that he did, and that in many senses it was entirely predictable, and that Trump made all the sense in the world for a Republican Party at that point that had become so incredibly and systemically weakened and vulnerable to that kind of takeover. So that's all I try to explain in the book, is that Trump did not materialize out of thin air, that he was not an anomaly, that in many ways he was exactly the culmination of American society and American politics on the right that we should have seen coming.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Tim Alberta.
It's my pleasure. Thanks.
And I've been speaking with Tim Alberta, who's a chief political correspondent for Politico magazine, where he covers Donald Trump's presidency, Capitol Hill, the ideological warfare between and within the two parties, demographic change in America, and the evolving role of money in elections. And he's the author of the new book, a national bestseller, American Carnage on the Front Lines of the Republican Civil War and the Rise of President Trump. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and engineer D'Angelo Jones. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can bookmark it, sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy this program, make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And be sure to share the program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And if you are in a position to support us so that we can sustain and build this program, visit us at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. Your support will help spread the word and keep us corporate-free, fearless, and independent. And we'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.